The following program is part of the Inner Circle Podcasting Group. Go to innercirclecomics.com for more high-quality podcasts.
Doom Patrol. Negative Man. Elastigirl. Robot Man.
Someone wants the Doom Patrol reunited.
Your every word and action is being broadcast across the planet.
Now, Monsieur Mana!
Well done, my Doom Patrol. Well done.
It is too late for you, Kaldao. Your beloved patrol is doomed.
Welcome to Waiting for Doom, the bestest and onlyest podcast about the Doom Patrol, where we lament the fact that they don't have a book and we talk about generally how awesome they are.
Hi everyone, I'm Paul, and you can find me on Twitter at reading_hicks. You can also email us if you wanted to type an email and press send. You'd have to put the address of waitingfordoom@gmail.com. We're on Facebook, not sure what that is, and most of our episodes are available on iTunes, Stitcher, Radio, and Podbean.com, because we've got a few banked up now, haven't we?
Just a few, yeah. This is episode 38 tonight. Whoa.
38? Bloody 38. Hell.
God.
Wow. It's almost as... shut up. And we're part of the Inner Circle Comics Cabal?
Network.
Cult?
Group.
Network? Coven. Anyway, something.
Check out innercirclecomics.com for some other awesome comics-related podcasts. I think that's what you meant to say, wasn't it?
Different but good.
Yes. Hi everyone, I'm Mike. You can find me on Twitter at AvantGarve. You can also find on Twitter our friend and sentient show Twitter account, Wilfred, at WFDPod.
Sometime friend, he turned on me this week.
Did he? Why did he turn on you?
I don't know.
Something about issues. Maybe missing someone's letter in the mailbag?
No, I don't know what you're talking about.
I'll have a look later while you're talking, and we'll see what Wilfred said. So I think he was trying to put the pony deal onto you.
The pony deal? No, that's non-transferable,
isn't it? What was it? Oh, okay, yeah. I just had a look. He really did lay into you, didn't he? Anyway, what are we talking about on tonight's show, Paul?
We're talking about Doom Patrol comics, specifically issues number 39, issue number 40, and as I realised after I read issue 40, issue 41 needs to be included at this point.
Pretty
to
much.
Make this a completely satisfying recording for us all.
Yes. And
And these are Grant Morrison Volume 2. Grant Morrison Volume 2, sorry, Doom Patrol.
Yes, and if you haven't already, we suggest you might want to go listen to episode 35 or go and read issues 37, 38 before getting much further into this episode, just so you've got a bit of background and context as to what the heck happens in this story.
Unless we're the draw, in which case, you're right, you can just listen to us because, you know, we've got sexy Aussie accents.
Oh, truth, do we ever, Cobber?
Too right, mate.
Too right. Oh, sexy, and we bloody well know it. Yes, but, well, yeah, they can go and listen to episode 35 and then come back and listen to this. I mean, we'll still be here. We'll get double us then.
Yep. Crap ton of us.
Yes. Anyway, how's your week been, Paul?
It's all right. Nothing to speak of, really.
Really?
I did note the DC solicits came out last week, and I took a couple of days before I looked at them. But I did notice that Grant Morrison Doom Patrol trades are coming back in a repackaged form. So what used to be trade 1 and 2, Crawling from the Wreckage and The Painting That Ate Paris, is now one big book.
Oh, wow.
And that will be out in January or February next year, 2016, for those of you listening from the future or from the past with a time machine. That's coming back. So that's good news because some of those trades are a bit tricky to find these days.
Yes, true.
Yeah. And they get cheaper. I mean, this is what DC does. If it's a series from the 80s, they will usually release one trade, then they'll wait like 500 years and then... they'll re-release the first trade, and then they'll do more trades. And if no one buys the first trade, then they'll stop there. But occasionally they just keep going, which is what's been happening with Suicide Squad trades finally.
Right.
It's like, here's one, a first trade. You can all enjoy that. And then there was years and years without a second trade. And now they're going, oh, here's the first trade again. And now here's the second trade because there's a movie coming, which is good. And that's why there's all these Deadshot books suddenly that you can buy trades of Deadshot stuff.
Right.
I'm rambling, aren't I?
No, no, it's fine. Get it out there, dude. Just get it out there. Vent.
Get it out.
It's your
okay.
show there. Vent, rant, you know.
Yeah.
The listeners will support you.
But no, okay, I'll go on a rant. I'm buying, I love DC Comics. I'm buying hardly any DC Comics. And right. the things I'm looking forward to are reprints of old DC Comics that I already own. So I'm actually more excited by buying things that I already own than new things coming out. Around the start of the New 52, just before the New 52, I was probably getting about 15, 16 series in trades from DC. Now I'm getting JLA, Justice League, and Batman maybe. I haven't decided if I'm going to keep going with that. And Astro City maybe.
Okay.
So, and that's it. That's it. I've just dropped everything else. I'm happy to try the one-off things, like I'm going to get the Amiga Man trade while it's still being published. I'm buying Prez because that stands alone and that appeals to me. But most of their ongoing stuff is a dead loss for me at the moment. So more excited by reprints of 1987 Suicide Squad than anything new they're doing. So that's
that.
A bit sad, isn't it?
Well... maybe in one point of view, but on the other point of view, it's a chance for you to revisit the stuff that you actually enjoy and that you know you love. And, you know, you can get a new
possibly.
Format. So there's nothing wrong with that. Nothing wrong with that at all, man.
Yeah.
It's
But, you know, I'm at the point where I feel like I could have an exit strategy from DC Comics completely.
Wow.
Like this would be, okay, I just need to get these and then I'm done. And I just look at what I've got already and enjoy that. Because, I mean, frankly, I've got that much that if I read two trades a week, I'd be reading till I died. So,
wow, anyway. It sounds like you've got it all planned out there.
Right, I'll just finish this wheel and then we can get on with the show.
Cool, okay.
What about you, Mike? in comics.
It was an okay/average-ish week. A bit disappointed that issue 5 of Green Lantern Lost Army killed off one of my favorite characters from the Green Lantern Corps. That was a bit of a bummer. One of the lanterns by the name of Druk, spelled J-R-U-K.
Oh, okay.
One-armed dude who also favored creating a axe out of his ring construct powers. He was really cool. I was a big fan of his. I believe he was created by Van Jensen when he was writing Green Lantern Corps.
It's not a Tomasi character.
Sorry?
It's not a Peter Tomasi character from
before? I'm not sure now.
It's Lights Out era.
Well, it was either Tomasi or Jensen. Let's say both of them credited. Fine. Anyway, Druk was awesome. He was very cool, and he got killed off in this issue, which was a bit of a bummer. Spoiler warning if you haven't read it. But anyway, Justice League is doing some interesting stuff with the Darkseid War and sort of delving into new gods-ish type territory, but the League are becoming the new gods almost. So that's kind of cool. And I'm quite surprised that I'm enjoying the new Amazing Spider-Man as much as I am. That was... yeah, because I'd kind of given up on all the Spider-Man books and decided to not revisit them. And then I got talked into it by a friend and sure enough, I'm back on. So,
I'm just suspicious of that friend.
The other interesting thing was I got to chat with a friend of the show, Chris Sabella, as part of his Kickstarter. I pitched in with a level where I got to have a Skype chat with him because he's been living at a clown motel in Tonopah, Nevada for the last month. So,
I've been following this on Twitter. It's hilarious.
It's quite bizarre and I can't wait to read. The reason was he was going to write a book about this motel because he stayed there previously for only a short time and then he thought, I'm going to, you know what, I'll stay there for longer and write a book about it. And he's got so much material now. It's just insane what he's experienced there. So, yeah, we teed up a time, and I was chatting with Chris as he was giving me a guided tour around the small mining cemetery, because it used to be a mining town way back when. And yeah, we had a lovely stroll in the middle of the night through this cemetery. So it was quite interesting. And the cemetery is right next to the Clown Motel. And it just sounds like the basis for a horror film. Like, you wouldn't believe. It's literally, walk out of the cemetery, oh look, I'm in the car park for the hotel, the Clown Motel. So that was really interesting. It was, we chatted for about a good 30 minutes on that. So it was good to catch up with Chris, make sure that he was alive and well. He was very keen for he was down to his last 6 days when we chatted, and he was very keen for them to fly by as quickly as possible. He was concerned that some of the weather report were indicating there might be snow, which might trap him in, because he did get, Tonopah got flooded in at one stage with a storm that they hadn't experienced the likes of for about 20-something years. So he timed that really well. So he was trapped there when the storm hit, and he was worried that similar might happen with possible snows. So, but look, he's on the home stretch now, so... You know, good luck, Chris, to get out of there. And I know he's very keen to get back home because there's basically very little to do in the middle of the desert there. So,
Well, and happy to hear that his book Welcome Back got extended into an ongoing.
Oh, definitely. That's actually a really good read. So,
couldn't happen to a nicer man.
That would have buoyed his spirits for sure out there in the desert. But So it's been an okay week. It's been an alright week. Interesting, but hey, can you hear that ticking?
That ticking in the background?
Yeah.
I think so.
Trust me, it's there. It's the doom clock. So, as we look at the doom clock once again, we can see that the last issue of a Doom Patrol book we had was issue 22 from volume 5, known as the Giffen Clark run. That was cover dated July 2011 and went on sale May 4th that same year.
May 4th, yeah.
And that means it's been 4 years and 25 weeks since our last Doom Patrol book. How's that make you feel, Paul?
How's that make you feel, man?
Pretty depressing.
Makes me feel a bit wacko.
A little bit, yeah.
A bit skittish, a bit on edge.
Yeah, a little bit.
Like I'm going to climb on the desk now. That's how it makes me feel.
Careful. The last appearance.
Don't talk me down, man. I've got to be up here.
Okay. I'll yell up to you so you can hear me. The last appearance of the team was 11 weeks ago, and actually in two different comic books. All-Star Section 8, Issue 3, had a cameo of the team in the background of a huge meeting of all the Justice League type heroes.
The heroes?
And Justice League United number 12 had a one panel appearance of the team, as Stargirl was talking to Robot Man about getting him to sign on for the JLU's next mission. And I hope everyone went out and bought JLU 14, because that was good fun.
The whole patrol.
Yeah, we hope to see the hashtag whole patrol. But this week in Doom Patrol history, on sale for US $2.50 on October 26th of 2005, with a cover date of December 2005, was issue 17 of volume 4. Which was the second last issue of the John Byrne run. I know that's a favourite of yours.
Second last. I don't even own that one.
Don't you? Well, it was a bit of a humdinger. The issue, titled Convergence Part 2, it actually had the Chief missing in action and presumed dead. It revealed more about the Negative Man's origin in that version of the team. And Nudge was in a coma. And her family was getting threatened by some evil stuff.
What about Grunt? What was Grunt up to?
Not sure. I can't remember. What we should do is get to that era of the Doom Patrol and we can read it for ourselves and you can find out.
When How's we say sound? Nunt and Grudge, are we just, you know, mistakenly doing shipper names for those two?
No, we're not. That was a slip of the tongue a long time ago and I'm glad you're not clinging to it.
Awesome.
Anyway, that's it for the Doom Clock this week.
This week on Doom's Planning, as promised, that's what we're all about, fulfilling our promises, aren't we? Mm. We're looking at Doom Patrol Volume 2, Number 39, which was published by DC Comics. What else can we say about it? It was cover dated December 1990. We're in the 90s.
Finally.
Yeah. Finally. But the actual day it came out, this is according to Mike's Amazing World of Comics, which is bloody amazing. I mean, I look at the amount of work in that and I feel like killing myself thinking about it. Anyway, he says that it came out on October 30, 1990, with a cover price of $1.50. $1.50.
Nice.
Chump change.
Yes.
Yeah. What can you buy for $1.50? That's like three Chupa Chups if you're lucky. Anyway, edited by Art Young, old Yoga Runt, as we call him. And it was titled Bell, Book and Candle. Who wrote it? It was Grant Morrison. It was penciled by the amazing Richard Case, friend of the show. We had the inker Mark McKenna. What? Why is he not a friend of the show?
I don't know. I honestly don't know if Richard Case has heard the show.
He's heard it talk about it.
Maybe.
Didn't you mention it? Yeah.
I'm sure I did. Yeah.
Yeah, okay. He's not an enemy of the show, I hope.
We wouldn't have enemies. Who? Why would we have enemies? Honestly,
We cross people. We burn bridges. Anyway, Mark McKenna was the inker. The other inker, there's two inkers on this. It's crazy. Kim DeMolder, and she's related to Kim DeScully. Could be him. I don't know. Letterer Johnny Workman Jr. Good old Johnny. He's always showing up for the letters. Mm-hmm. And the colorist was Daniel Vozzo, and the cover was by Simon Bisley. And it's a bit of a schmozzle.
it's like
half a rocky skull with a city sort of imposed on, photoshopped on top of it or something.
Yes, a very interesting take on the Judgment Rock in the story.
Yes. So,
yes.
Anyway, let's get into it, which involves me opening this comic ear. Okay, so when we last left the Doom Patrol, they'd just arrived at the Insect Mesh. Well, the team is split in two, so... Rhea Lodestone, who's now naked with eyes. That will make sense if you see the visual. She has been kidnapped by the, what are they called? The Geomancers of the Sun.
Geomancers of the Ultraquist.
Thank you. Thank you, Mike. That's all right. This is why I don't do a podcast on my own. yes. So they have been kidnapped by one side of these aliens, and there's another group of aliens called whatever. Anyway, they're...
Orthodoxy of the Mesh.
Thank you, Mike. Once again, you're proving your worth.
Wow.
Yes, so they have Cliff and... What's her face? Crazy Jane.
Crazy Jane. Oh, it's going to be a long episode, this one.
Bloody hell. I'd hate to be this poor sucker editing this one. Anyway, it opens with a prologue, which is actually setting up a story that's to come. Let's not go into it. There's a woman looking for some bloke called Flex Mentello, who we have already met thanks to Danny the Street, and she comes to a creepy place where there's so she's like a seance lady with phones, and it goes horribly wrong for this lady. And her name's Watson, which, anyway, you don't have to dwell too much on that, but, you know, there's something creepy going on in the background.
Yes.
All right, then we get to the title page, and Jane is really impressed with outer space, like this alien planet, even though it looks a little bit like some of the other Grant Morrison realms that we've seen in this comic before. It's lots of twisted cathedrals and stuff. Cliff's a bit jaded by it, but as they're zooming through, they're getting prepared to, you know, what is the cage, and they're getting explained to them, and they're being told more about the war, which they already know about. So there's some pretty cool visuals as they get to the end destination, and they meet the anathematicians who are in charge of running everything on this side of the war. Cut back to Earth, and we see that Dorothy, the ape-faced girl, is giving Flex Mentello a haircut. And he wants to look like his old self, and that's what happens at the end of the haircut, and he's very happy. And he gets rid of his Alan Moore beardy stuff. And
Alan Moore. Sorry.
It's all that Aussie talk at the start. Alan Border, Aussie cricketer. Bloody legend, mate.
Mm-hmm.
He's a dead set bloody legend.
But yes, I like how at the start of the page, he looks like Alan Moore. Dorothy gives him the haircut and the shave, and then the last panel of the page is like, I'm Flex Mentello. Like, he's ready to kick ass again.
He looks like a completely different person.
Yes.
Yes, he's got a very sensible short haircut. Okay, so prepping for the war, and they get attacked. This dog called a smoke dog gets teleported into the place where they are and starts to attack Cliff very violently. Absolutely rips his lower parts off, and Cliff takes advantage of them being a mature reader's book at this point to swear a bit and saying shit. Yeah, and we're kind of expecting, you know, Jane to jump in, and she does. So she turns into Black Annis,
yes,
who's like the clawed monstrous woman, and she starts attacking the dog. Then she turns back before she, you know, she starts to rant a bit as Annis, and then Cliff is really suffering, like, but he's not suffering too much that he can't make a joke, and he says, "Give it to me straight, Doc. Will I ever dance on Broadway?"
And he's leaving this trail of, like, I don't know, brake fluid or something, and all his innards are out all over the floor. I mean, yeah, nice he can crack a joke about it all.
Yeah, I mean, so everyone took a drink because Cliff got ripped apart, but I think this is probably one of the most violent ripping aparts of Cliff Steele we've seen in the comic.
In this volume so far, yeah. And normally it's just a limb or something, and it's his entire lower half is gone.
We cut to the other side of the wall, which is where Huss is talking to Rebus and Rhea. You know, basically both sides are getting shown around. So on this side, they are seeing that they have a thing called the Shadow Cabinet, which keeps all the essences of their previous leaders. Yeah, there's a lot of gobbledygook going on here, isn't there?
Just a bit, yeah. It's preparing for a war with a lot of Morrison speak over the top of it. Yeah.
Yeah. We cut back to the other side. The anathematicians are doing their summoning, I think, to take the war to the next level.
They're so preparing there's a lot of for their pheromone communion.
Pheromone communion? That's a very Grant Morrison concept.
Yeah.
Yeah. The dude whose name I've forgotten, who's walking them round, is explaining that the dead dog that Jane killed is going to be dumped into their pit, and they'll pull it apart and learn everything about it. And then we get the pheromone communion starts, and we get a lot of sort of third person narration from somewhere.
Yes.
And we see the effect of it on people. So it's sort of like a sexual sort of communion feeling thing where everyone goes into sort of these orgasmic trances and stuff. But, I mean, it's interesting that all the aliens start to look like people at this stage, just so you can communicate these concepts, because I think if you'd done it with aliens, it wouldn't look like anything.
Yeah, I think it means a bit more that they're more humanoid-looking people than the weird planks with the white orbs for a head,
yeah,
like the priests of the Orthodoxy are. But, yeah, it's a weird thing where it's like the insect hive mind is infecting these people's bodies through this process, but the insects are also manifesting themselves and becoming actual insects in their bodies, which is...
Yeah, and we see images of, like, you know, centipedes and bugs all writhing all over each other, and then see that reflected in the, you know, the people sort of writhing about.
Yeah.
It's pretty weird. Yeah. Anyway. Jane and the other guy are talking.
She's being led around by this priest who's basically giving her, you know, bring her up to speed on this whole communion thing, and that, you know, they come across a person or group of people even asleep in the streets of the cage, this gigantic city. And she says, "Well, what's wrong with this guy?" And the priest says, "Well, nothing. It's just, you know, many eggs are hatching from their dreaming heads, shining soldiers for the war." So it's like, okay, they've knocked out their own people. They're going to hatch insect soldiers from their head. Cool.
Yep.
Good work, Morrison.
Yeah. And Cliff was taken away to be repaired. But while they're talking, Jane says, "What's that sound?" And then starts to see this shadowy spider legs on the wall. And she's obviously not in her dominant personalities, because she gets afraid of the spider, doesn't she?
Yeah, just a bit.
And it turns out it's not a spider, and we get the last page reveal that it's actually Cliff, who's now been given robot spider legs.
Yeah. Spider Cliff.
So it's Spider Cliff. It's a pretty cool reveal, actually.
It is, yeah. We'll have to put pictures up of Spider Cliff.
Yeah, and he undermines that moment of awesomeness by saying, just thought I'd slip into something a little more comfortable.
Ah, Cliff, you dork.
Oh, dear. Mm. So, my thoughts on this comic is it's got a 3-page prologue, mm-hmm. which, yeah, I think I came out of this one just a little bit irritated by it all.
Yeah.
Like, you know, Morrison is exploring all these concepts that seem to amuse himself, perhaps. I think this could be a harsh way of putting it, but, you know, there's lots of interesting... The pheromone communion is just an interesting idea to explore and explain and, you know, sort of... Yeah, but I don't know. Like, this story is 3 parts, and at the end of it, I just felt it really begged to be put down into... Actually, it's 5 parts. We've already done 2.
Yes.
This is the last 3.
Mm-hmm.
It could be done in 4 better, probably even 3.
I would lean more towards 3 than yeah. 4 would be acceptable. Yeah, the 5-parter. By the time we get to the end of it, yeah. It's quite a ride.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, we had a comment in the Facebook, and you know how I cherish the Facebook.
Oh, yeah.
This was from Mark Gray, and he was talking about it the last time we talked about Grant Morrison episode. And he said, top of episode, or as I would say, fancy. These issues were when Grant Morrison jumped the shark in a jar, when the book became a parody itself. The randomly generated weirdness became the point rather than the background to the world of Cliff and Co. When everything is weird all the time, nothing is weird. And I think he's really got a point here.
Yep, I concur 100%. With that.
Yeah, the book really got disconnected from reality in this mm-hmm. this arc,
yeah.
And you had very little to grasp onto, and you know the characters were all in unfamiliar settings, and they, you know, mostly nonplussed by it all. Yeah. Anyway, shall we continue?
Let's continue on with issue number 40, titled "Battlefield of Dreams."
Dreams.
Battlefield of Dreams. That's right.
Dreams.
We open up with...
If you build it, they will come.
Right. Sure they will. The issue opens with another prologue. We meet very briefly a gent by the name of Mr. Christmas, who's being...
Merry Christmas.
...harassed by some secret agent types wearing green gloves and green shirts. They tell him that, hey, that book you thought you were writing called The Secret Government, which was... you were going to use to expose us, that's actually all gibberish, because in the past we made a lesion in the angular gyrus of his brain's temporal lobe. Now, do you know what an angular gyrus of the temporal lobe actually does, Paul?
No, I do not.
It's actually involved in a number of processes related to language, number processing, and spatial cognition, memory retrieval, attention, and theory of mind. So it's kind of important in the brain.
You can't accuse Morrison of not doing his research.
Yeah. So basically, the gents take him away, and he asks about the teaspoon, which we did mention back in episode 35, when that was full of prologues as well.
The tongs, aren't they? Tea tongs, sugar tongs.
Sugar tongs. There we go. Now you
sugar tongs.
I was so close. I knew it was cutlery of some sort.
It's much easier when I'm not doing the main bit. Interrupt you.
And then he's asking, you know, what the Pentagon really is, and he basically gets shoved in a car and gets told, you're getting taken to somewhere called the Ant Farm. So that's more mysterious mysteries that will get covered in greater detail in later issues. So anyway, into the story proper, we return to the Mesh, where the Orthodoxy are preparing for their war still. They have their Thought Forms army at the ready, so all those soldiers that were being hatched in the minds of the sleeping people, they've come to fruition. Cliff is continuing to adjust to his new legs, and the priest that's been accompanying him and Jane douses him with a perfume that smells like a smoke dog to protect him from the smoke dogs. Because the only sense that the dogs really have is smell. So he's thinking, yeah, that might protect you a little bit better. So I think that was part of what they got out of the smoke dog they sacrificed when they were preparing the pheromone communion. So on the other side of the battlefield, the Huss is talking with Rhea and Rebus, and Huss is ensuring that Rhea knows her part in his plan to make a change in the war. And he wants her to fly to the Judgment Rock and wait for his signal, because he's got plans and things are going to happen according to how he wants them to. So at this point, Cliff and Jane and the Orthodoxy forces, they enter the first battlefield zone, which is the zone of mindless walls. So walls are just appearing up and trying to crush our heroes. So Cliff, of course, he's clearly quite used to his new legs and manages to blast the walls apart with his new leg-mounted cannons. So that's kind of handy.
Leg cannons, yeah.
Leg cannons. We cut quickly and we see that Rhea's flying towards the massive Judgment Rock and she's doing what's asked of her. And Cliff and co, they enter the next zone called the Zone of Dismay. And Cliff stops and thinks, you know, this war makes no sense. Neither side appears to have ever made any gains on it. And just at that point, another smoke dog appears. We cut away again. It keeps cutting back and forth between both sides of the war here. We learn that the Hussars used the power of the Kaleidoscape to create essentially thousands of copies of itself to fight in the war. So that's where all their soldiers have come from. And Huss also reveals that the Earth is actually a sacred place of pilgrimage for the UltraQuest people. And it's rumored that that's where the Judgment Rock originated from. Because apparently it's an angel.
Oh.
Yeah, so we're getting weirder and weirder as we go along.
And he explains too that Rhea is actually like a magnetic part of the Earth's magnetic force, but they got her away from there before she bonded to the Earth.
That's right.
So I wonder if she's like, you know, sort of Swamp Thing is the avatar of the green. Maybe she's the avatar of the magnetic force. I mean, this isn't a thought that's in the comic, but maybe it's like that.
Maybe. Could be. Yeah. So
maybe.
It was during one of these UltraQuest pilgrimages. Yeah, that's when they detected Lodestone. But Rebus comments that he figures out why the Huss wants to destroy the flower, which is encased in glass, within the Judgment Rock. And if you want that to make more sense, that's why we say go and listen to episode 35. Because that's what Huss is chasing. There's some powerful flower encased in glass deep within the Judgment Rock, and he wants Rhea to go and get it. So all caught up now? Good.
Yeah. But he says to Huss, why don't you just admit you're afraid to die?
Mm.
And that really ticks him off.
Just a bit.
And then he surrounds Rebus with swords and knives that he creates from midair.
A little bit cranky.
Thin air.
Yeah. Meanwhile, Cliff is busy blasting away at the attacking smoke dogs, and Jane uses another one of her personalities who I don't think we've seen before. But she refers
this is
to
Flit.
It. Flit. Can you recall seeing Flit before now?
Yeah, we've seen Flit before.
Where do we see Flit?
Flit was in the painting that ate Paris story.
Oh, okay. See, geez, that was a few episodes back.
Yeah.
It's a while ago now.
It's a while ago. Back in the day.
So Flit manages to teleport away with one of the smoke dogs, and we have a rather hair-raising page where she rematerializes in midair and is sort of plummeting to her death.
It's like she's forgotten that she can teleport.
Yes. So we cut back to see Rhea entering the Judgment Rock. She's walking through this gigantic deserted mansion and these huge hallways, and this is where she comes across the flower encased in the glass. And yeah, there's all weird echoes and words she can hear throughout the mansion. It's very weird and spooky. So Jane reappears, or Jane using Flit's personality and power, she reappears just as Cliff and co. are hit by a glass swarm. And this was a bit that confused me. I know this is another one of her forms, but it's like a river stream, but in the shape of her body. And somehow she used that to divert the glass swarm.
It's like she turns into water, but sort of phased out of reality, so that the glass swarm doesn't get her somehow.
And I
it's
know
not explained, but I like that it's not explained.
Yeah, I know that we've seen that form of Jane before, but I can't remember the name of that personality at the moment. But yeah, she prevents a glass swarm by turning into water, of course. And finally, we cut back to the Judgment Rock. Rhea's got the glass encased flower in her hand, and she says, "You know what? I've got better things to do than wait for a signal." And she uses her magnetic power to start this Judgment Rock, this gigantic floating citadel with rocks carved faces on either side of it. And she brings it crashing down on top of the battle that's ensuing between the Orthodoxy and the UltraQuest. And all hell breaks loose.
And it goes back to what Huss said when she flew away. He said, "There's something wayward stroke capricious about the lodestone. It worries me."
Yeah. Yeah, she kind of did her own thing there. So, yeah. So issue 40, it ramps up the weirdness even more.
Yeah.
So with this issue, we had the exact same team as before. We had Morrison and Case leading McKenna, Johnny Workman Jr. and Daniel Vozzo. It was also $1.50. It was cover dated January 91. Actually went on sale November 28th, 1990. So, yeah, it was... It's a
get on with it. That's what I felt at the end of this.
Yeah, it's a Morrison. It's a war story done Morrison style, and you kind of want it to wrap up really quick. So, yeah.
Shout out to the cover by Simon Bisley. It's a robot spider legs robot man. That's pretty cool.
Yep. The cover's probably the coolest thing. Yeah.
And it's presented in landscape format.
Yeah. Something different.
So it is designed to be tilted.
Although it could be that he could be climbing up the wall, this spider leg, the way that his jacket falls behind him.
Wow. I don't think that way.
Well, there you go. You're welcome. But yeah, this issue, it was kind of, okay. As you said before, four issues probably would have been a better scale for this story. Because we've still got issue 41 to get through yet.
Yeah. Okay. So issue 41 is called Fallen Angel, and it came out February 1991, which is a month after January, which is weird. This one was on sale on the 2nd of January 1991. So, you know, you could wake up with your hangover and go out and buy it. Buck Fitty, Art Young, editor. Writer Grant Morrison, penciler Richard Case, inker Mark McKenna, Kim DeMolder back to help with the inks, letterer John E. Workman Jr., and Daniel Vozzo on the colours. So, this one wraps up the story. It's got a very abstract cover.
I think it's meant to represent Lodestone in the middle of the battle, I guess, but in a very stylized version.
Yeah, you do have to do a bit of mental exercises to match that into the story.
Took me. I got there eventually.
Yeah. Anyway, and we have the final prologue called Lost and Found, which has this woman still looking for Flex Mentallo, and she goes to Dolores Watson, and she goes to a Lost and Found office in a train station, I would say, and creepy man helps her into the back and shows her, talks to her about some of the things we've heard about in the comic before, like the missing airmen from Flight 19, sailors on the USS Eldridge, things like that. And as he's talking to her, a very creepy mechanical hand pulls back the curtain. She turns around and someone off screen makes her die, I presume.
It's pretty strongly implied that she's killed.
There's a spray of blood on the guy.
Yeah.
And he says, "Is it real? Is it real? Is it real?"
Oh, God.
I don't know.
Let's say yes.
Who knows?
Yes.
Anyway, back in space, on the title page, we see the Judge Rock has now crumbled onto the ground. There's wreckage everywhere. Cliff pushes rocks off, and he's been protecting Jane under his robot legs. The Orthodoxy are kind of horrified that the Judge Rock's been brought down. And then we see that one of their little spaceshipy things has survived. And it's the Anathemancers, and they've left the cage. And he says, they never leave the cage, never. We have come to the end of all meaning and certainty, I'll say. And then the two armies are face to face. And Huss is gloating, saying that, "I am triumphant, stroke victorious. The Kaleidoscape has defeated the mesh at last." Huss is triumphant. And the team are reunited. So Larry, Rebus has floated over with Huss, and Robin says, "Larry, you don't know how glad I am to see you. You okay, man?" And Rebus very, very distractedly says, "Fine." He's only asked. And Huss is claiming his victory and how he brought it down. And then Rhea appears and said, you know, you didn't. I brought down the Judge Rock. It was me. And I found this. And she holds up the flower, which is sort of encased in this glassy stuff. And Huss says, it's mine, and tries to grab it. And she uses her magnetic powers to push him away. And then she chucks it to Cliff. And says, and he says, what am I supposed to do with this? And she says, take it back into the rock. You'll know what to do when you get in there. He says, I'll take your word for it.
We should probably point out that this flower is from the primal tree. And apparently it's a flower of life and knowledge. So it's a pretty powerful artifact in this setting.
Yeah, but Huss tries to stop this happening, and then Rhea uses her powers to knock him on his ass. Rebus intervenes and says, you know, he's saying, Huss is saying it's my strength that brought of purpose that brought down the rock, and Rebus sees an opening to try something different with the war, and he says, how strong are you? And he introduces a concept called a potlatch, which I may be pronouncing wrong. Now, I love the concept of the potlatch, but basically the theory is, potlatch is a Chinook word used by the Kwatul and Tling tribes. That's not easy, but back on Earth. A potlatch ceremony involves the exchange of gifts. One tribe would offer something and the other tribe had to respond with an item of greater value. This often continued until one tribe was forced to destroy its own town, thus raising the obligation of the opposing tribe to an intolerable level. So it's like, who's willing to sacrifice the most to prove that they're the one with the least to lose. So instantly both sides get it. So Huss starts it and said, well, I'll show you the strength. And he kills one of his soldiers straight away by chucking rocks through them. Priests of the Orthodoxy say, match this then, blasphemer. And then they destroy this little spaceship. And then Jane's going, this is crazy. And Rebus is going, it's no more mad than the way they've conducted this war. So the priests of the Orthodoxy next destroy their emblems of holy office, which are the little globey things that they're carrying around. And so they crush them up as they stab their hands. Huss retaliates by destroying something in the center of the kaleidoscope. It's a region of ultimate beauty and perfect stability. And he just destroys it. He said, I destroys it now.
And he basically snaps his fingers and, shit starts blowing up everywhere.
Then the priest's communion, then they say, we're going to destroy the pics of the communion. And the priest who's with Jane is horrified that they're going to do that. And then they do that. And they blow up their communion thing with all the insects in it.
Yeah, exploding bugs everywhere.
Yeah. Huss takes it upon himself to destroy their shadow cabinet, which is all the souls of the former people who run the kaleidoscape. And then he destroys it and it blows up around him.
I like how he says,
immediately regrets it.
I like how he says, there is nothing in the world more important, stroke significant to us. Nothing. Nothing. And he blows it all up. Yeah. And then he says, what has I done?
Anyway, Cliff returns from his errand where he's gone and planted the flower. He says, wow, you turn your back. No, he said, geez, you turn your back for 20 minutes and the whole place falls apart. And he explains that he planted the flower and it seemed to make the most sense. And then we get some third-person narration as the flower takes root and grows into a tree and it brings the Judge Rock back to life. And everyone's wondering what happens, but Rhea knows, and she's, it's an angel, like I said. And she knows the name, and it's Balzilzerus, or Balzodizorus. Oh, we're having another...
Chemozoid.
moment.
Giacomo.
Yeah.
Paramecium.
On behalf of Mike and myself, I'd like to apologise for this podcast.
hey, come on, hey. It's not that bad.
Yeah. Anyway, she explains it was one of several angels sent to watch over man after the fall, and one of its tasks was to transform Eden from a physical reality into an abstract idea. And then it went off into space to do that, and it stole a cutting from the original tree of knowledge. So it's a bit religious. And then she explains that this is why the war was so simplistic, because it's been a... Yes.
Because it had no imagination.
Yeah, it was a war without any imagination. So no one could actually create anything new. They could only manipulate what was already there, which doesn't make a lot of sense in this story because it seems to be very imaginative. All these zones of dismay and zones of words that kill and zones of...
But that might just be normality for the two opposing sides, and they're just stuck in an endless loop of war with, you know, nothing really... That's the thing, the war went for so long and nothing was ever really new or changed in it until this event happened. So, yeah.
I love that when Cliff says, so it's an angel, and Rhea goes, well, it's either that or a psychic projection of a woman, now Ilse Krauss, who's lying on a hospital bed in Bremen dying of brain cancer. It's hard to be sure. Just toss that in.
A bit morbid, but yeah.
Yeah. So Huss is despairing and... the priest is there with him, and then he suddenly says, I had an idea. For the first time in existence, I've had an idea. We are to build a tower, mesh and kaleidoscape in collaboration, a beautiful tower with its roots in the foundations of the earth and its heights in the heavens. And they all go, hurrah!
Hurrah! It's a great idea.
So just like the Tower of Babel from the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. Cliff is concerned about the team now they're all back together. He asks Jane if she's okay, and she said, oh, sorry, I was just trying to remember the name of the guy who was Al Pacino's partner in Dog Day Afternoon.
Of course, after everything that's happened.
Yeah. Cliff said, oh, well, we can all go home. You're all set to go home, Rhea? And she's like, oh, I like the look of that. See that there? I think I'll go there while I'm still young. And she points at a star and flies away. And we never see her again.
Never, ever. That's it. She doesn't even say goodbye.
No.
She's like, I'm going to go visit that star. Oh, I'll come visit you, you know, when I can. See ya. No, she doesn't even say see ya. That's it.
Doesn't say goodbye to Josh or anyone.
No. She just says, don't worry, I'll visit. Then she goes. That's it. That's cold, Rhea. That's cold.
Well, she's sort of transcended regular humanity at this point,
I guess.
It ends with Rebus talking about some of the ideas he's had for his future, and sort of because he was talked about a bit by Huss about being the Ouroboros, you know, the snake eating its own tail. And Cliff sums up the entire story by saying, screw symbolism and let's go home.
Yeah. Says it all, really.
I like the ending. I really like the potlatch, and I like the way it all concluded. It was very, very different and clever. It's the first time I'd ever seen that in fiction, and probably the last time I ever saw that in fiction, where
I think
people challenging just themselves to sacrifice more and more.
I think the potlatch concept was the saving grace of the story.
Yeah.
Because the rest of it...
Yeah, and when I started the story, I thought, oh, good, this is the one with the potlatch. And then I was like, oh, it's in the fifth issue. I didn't realize that.
Yeah. It's, as you said, it's a five-part story that should not have gone for five parts. To me, it seemed like Morrison was thinking, okay, I've not really got anything to do with Rhea, and I've got this other storyline coming up, focusing on Flex Mentallo and, you know, the ant farm and what's really Pentagon. Going on in the Pentagon. And I want to get to that. So, what can I do to bide my time till I finish working on that story? I know, I'll create a batshit fucking crazy war story in outer space and do that for five issues. That's how angry I am about this storyline.
It's just getting your swears on.
Yep. I'll have to make sure I mark it as explicit when I post this episode. Yeah. But yeah, it's not one of the best stories in the Morrison run.
No, I think it does drag. I mean, and to be honest, I feel like I would have loved to have seen Rhea come back and become part of the DC Universe somehow.
That would be awesome.
Even if she left
back.
The title and just became, you know, a free agent in the DC Universe. That would be pretty cool.
Even just a one-issue cameo for her to come back and say, hey, here's all the wacky stuff I've been doing in space. How are you guys doing? Oh, let's have a quick adventure. Okay, see you later. Till next time. Something.
Yeah. And it'd be quite fun to see her getting a uniform to cover, you know, cover everything except her new eyes.
Yeah. So it really did seem like, you know, just a way to get rid of that character and drop hints about the upcoming storyline and just, you know, cover it with a nice big crazy cake of just weirdness. I mean, yeah, there were some interesting ideas and some cool stuff with, you know, the Orthodoxy and the Ultraquist and their bizarre powers and how they work. That was, yeah, that was well done. You can't fault Morrison for being creative and inventive with that stuff. But the story itself, it's not a great one.
But I'm quite happy to get to the end of this one.
As we said before, and as our friend Martin Gray said, this is when he really ramped up the weirdness. And I know that this is the stuff that starts to get really challenging for people to read. And even though people go, oh my God, Morrison's Doom Patrol, that was the stuff, man. That was awesome stuff. I'm kind of like, really? I mean, yes, he had some good stuff. I mean, one of my favorite stories is the one involving the Candlemaker. The Candlemaker terrified me when I first read it. And that story, that's brilliant. Awesome stuff there. But, you know, we have some dodgy patches to get through before we get to the really good stuff. Unfortunately, this is one of those patches.
But, I mean, we are pretty much of a like mind and like experience. So if this is your jam, please let us know. We'd love to hear from you all.
Oh, definitely, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I'm very open to the idea that I'm, you know, someone else may think this is fantastic and explain why.
Mm.
Maybe Chris Sabella loves it.
Maybe he does.
Mm.
Shit. I think we doomsplained the hell out of that one.
We sure did. Mm. Let's move on to the mailbag, O'Doom. This week on the mailbag O'Doom, we asked everybody what comic would make a great video game, and didn't we get a lot of answers?
Mm, we did.
They were bloody great answers right out the gate. So Ange, Dr. Ange 70 on Twitter, friend of the show, he said, Dial H for Heroes, so many new characters to unlock, design your own, crazy scenarios. That is a bloody brilliant idea.
That would be cool.
Yeah. Awesome.
We heard from R.I.P. Van Winkle, and they said, I always wanted American Vampire, but I think Sweet Tooth would make a more interesting game by Telltale Games, who did The Walking Dead and The Fables, kind of story-based role-playing type games. But yeah, that would be interesting. Yeah,
that would also work. That's very suited to Sweet Tooth.
Yeah.
We heard from Bobgar Ornelas, who's at Slurmo, and he said, Resurrection Man. Each level explores new powers. Dying screws with your powers. You can DC 1 million and choose powers in the final stage. That is awesome. Nice. I love Resurrection Man. Now, do you know Resurrection Man much?
I do. They did a reboot of it, not in the New 52, was it? But just before
that. Yeah, it was.
Yeah, well, whichever the last series was, that's the one I read. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So he had a deal where whenever he dies, nanites would rebuild his body straight away, and he'd get different powers.
Mm.
And in DC 1 million, he had an instant way of dying and coming back immediately. So he had this like a alien scorpion thing in a container on his arm that would kill him whenever he needed it to, and he could choose his powers in the. That was DC 1 million was set in the future.
Mm. Yes. Mm. We heard from Moby One at Shmoby One, and he said, Dead Man, choose which hero to inhabit to take down level bosses. Answer inspired by excellent Dial H and Resurrection Man answers earlier. But still, Dead Man would be cool to see, you know, and just have him 1 minute take over, you know, Joe Average on the street to spy on the bad guys, and then, you know, have him take over Superman's body or something like that. That'd be cool.
Yeah, and you could put like Donald Trump in it and people like that.
Okay. Are you saying Donald Trump would be one of the level bosses that he had to take down?
one of the villains.
Yes, of course. You could do that.
Yeah. We heard from Cal Cleary, new to the show, who's at Comica Librarian.
Mm-hmm.
Cal said Gillen's Iron Man as a BioWare style action RPG. Instead of new party members, you research, build new seat styles to change play. That sounds pretty cool.
That'd be cool. Yeah.
Yeah.
We heard from Karthik Kakarala, who this week is known as Alt 2015 Karthik. I think that's to do with time travel and alternate dimensions. He said video games have caught up to the point where Spurrier's X-Men Legacy run, starring Legion, could be a great game. Now, I never read that comic, but I know Legacy was Charles Xavier's son, and he had, I think, all these different imaginable powers. So I'm not quite sure what he could do with them in a game setting, that is.
Yeah, my familiarity with Legion and Legacy and all that is lacking.
Mm. But yeah, Legion kind of had every power imaginable, so he'd be pretty unstoppable, I think.
Awesome. We heard from the fleshy one, Hogan, who's at Unlikely Nerd, or Chris, as we sometimes call him, and he said the Daredevil done in a similar style to the Arkham games could be a lot of fun. Also, bring back team games like X-Men Legends.
Yeah, cool.
Daredevil would make a great Arkham-style game.
Mm.
Mm. It's very suited for that character.
We heard from Stu Art Cox at Striker CX, and he said Dark Moon Comic by at Dark Moon Comic would make an interesting game. Already has great visuals coupled with a cool soundtrack. Okay, to be honest, I've not checked out Dark Moon Comic, so
no, I haven't either.
I'll have to look into that.
We heard from Striker's One Hacker Time Went Vile, and he said Madman Kinchy. That would be a pretty fun, colourful video game.
Yes. Yeah. Chris Rummel at My Junk and Trunk said a great game would be a 1984 Secret Wars. That would be cool.
Oh, you could do it in 16-bit.
Yeah, and I was thinking, you know how in this modern games all have those amiibo figures, I think they're called? What if they did it with like the old 1984 style action figures and the shields that they had? That'd be cool.
Superpowers line. That's
yeah, right. Yeah. Ooh. Now you're talking. Now you're talking.
That'd be good. Now we heard from Andy Turner a lot. He's at SuperAndyT83, and he said Avengers Arena. You could make a custom expendable character to take part in arcade deathmatch, or perhaps a Martian Manhunter game with a split between investigation and action, like L.A. Noir, but with a super Martian, or perchance a 30 Days of Night survival horror base resource manager. I could and likely will go on. Going indie, I could go for a Red Mask from Mars 2D scrolling beat 'em up. Feel free to become game dev anytime, Jester Diablo. Is that the creator? Anyway, or the artist. And regardless of gameplay, you could make a game based on sex criminals, and the game would likely hype itself on title alone. That is probably true.
I wonder what sort of game the sex criminals one would be, though.
I don't know. It's, excuse me, I'm just going to play sex criminals.
Oh, that could be a bit awkward. We heard from Martin Gray, at Mart Gray, and he said, video games, Injustice, Gods Among Us, or Sonic? Yeah.
Sure. I think Mart's a massive gamer from that answer.
Sounds it, clearly, yes.
And lastly, but not leastly, we heard from Doug Sawisa, who's a chemozoroid this week. And he said, answer of the week, Doom Patrol video game or Captain Carrot. So, yep.
I'll go with the former, not the latter.
What about you, Mike? You got an answer?
I was thinking kind of like an action-adventure type game based on Animal Man. And he had to, you know, you have to solve a puzzle in each sort of level by, first of all, finding animals in that level and then using their powers to get past the puzzles and solve the mysteries and fight the bad guys. That'd be cool to see.
Cool.
I like a bit of Animal Man. Yeah. What about you, Paul?
I would love to have a game called Justice League Tycoon, where you are like Max Lord trying to bring a Justice League together that's the best Justice League. And you could have multiplayer, so you could have someone who's playing, what's his name? Thayer Jost.
Okay. Yep.
Yeah, and he's putting together a team. So you could have, you know, you're trying to attract people to join your team, manipulate them into, you know, bad guys to attack them so they look good and all this sort of stuff. I don't know, that'd be pretty fun.
That'd be cool. Kind of like a resource manager, kind of Sims type game, but being an evil, crazy tycoon.
Yeah. Could be Lego as well. I don't mind.
Oh, God. Justice League Lego Tycoon Manager. Right. Oh, that sounds like a winner.
And we got an email from Arbad, who wanted to get in touch with us about Morrison Doom Patrol. So he said, I think I first met the Doom Patrol mid the space travel storyline. It's hard to tell because it's over 20 years ago. For many years after, I knew I loved the series but only had a vague recollection of the plot lines. Everything around it was so fuzzy. Since I had not read the Drake, Premiani nor the Kupperberg series until the late 2000s, I just assumed Lodestone was a major character in Doom Patrol history. Whoops. All this because of issues 37 to 41. It's nice to revisit them again with you guys. Thanks, Arbat.
Thanks, Arbat. Yeah, it's. I wish Lodestone had been more of a major character.
Yeah.
She could have done so much more, but nah, she just flew off into space. Wow. Yeah. But yeah, no, thanks for joining us, Arbat. It's always good to hear from the listeners.
Yeah. But that's all for this ep. So if you want to get in touch, there's the Twitter at WFDpod. Say hi to Wilfred. You can email us at waitingfordoom@gmail.com. We've got the Facebook page. And next week on the show, it's a very exciting show. We're going to talk about Supergirl. And we know someone who likes to talk about Supergirl and knows more about Supergirl than we do. So we'll be joined by Dr. Ange.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. He's the man. Yeah. And the question for next week is, what character / characters would you like to see graduate to have their own comic book?
Now, graduate from where?
Well, if they could be part of a team, or they could be a character who's never had their own title. So if they've had their own miniseries or something, then they can't be eligible for this answer.
Okay.
So think of people who sit in the background. Who you think would be awesome. You know, maybe you think Killer Croc would make a fantastic ongoing. Maybe. Like Poison Ivy's about to get one. Anyway.
Yeah. But will the Doom Patrol get their own book this year? No. Of course not. Sorry, Poison Ivy and Killer Croc fans.
Yeah.
Cool.
Anyway, that's it. That's it. We'll get out of here and we'll talk to you all next week.
Thanks for listening, guys. See ya.
Thinking about shipper names.
Have you just?
Yeah.
But
Steve Dayton, Rita Farr, Farden.
Oh, God. Wow, that's classy. Got any more?
No, I haven't thought that much.
Right.
You just give it time.
You just went for the fart joke.
Cliff and Rita, Cleta.
Oh, God.
Talking of the burn run. Quick, get us out of this doom clock.
Wow. Fart.
Sorry.
No, you're not. Okay.
Sorry. I'm a bit manic tone, I think.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Scott Fisher is awesome.
So what was that, Paul?
Nothing, I'm just talking to Martin.
Scott Fisher's awesome, did you say? Sorry, I think I picked up a bit of static. Yeah, couldn't quite hear you there.
Good night.